This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Support for KKFI is provided by the Literacy Lab. Do you believe literacy is a human right? The Literacy Lab is looking for people to shape lives. They train and place literacy tutors in schools throughout Kansas City to work one-on-one with students to build strong readers. Literacy Lab is hiring for the upcoming 2019-20 school year. More information about programs and how to apply to become a literacy tutor at theliteracylab.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
There's no business like show. Everything about it is appealing. Everything the traffic will allow. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling when you are stealing that extra bow. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are alone. Yesterday they told you you would not go far. That night you opened and there you are. Next day on your dressing room they costumes, the scenery, the makeup, the props, the audience that lifts you when you're down. The headaches, the heartaches, the backaches, the flops, the sheriff who escorts you out of town. The opening when your heart beats like a drum. The closing when the customers don't come. Like no business I know. You get word before the show has started that your favorite uncle died at dawn. And top of that, your partner might have parted. You're brokenhearted, but you go on. There's no people like show people. They smile when they are low. Even with a turkey that you know will fold, you may be stranded out.
Hello and welcome once again to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I am Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on Monday. Wasn't it a beautiful weekend? For the most part, it rained at times, but it was a beautiful weekend out there. Hope you enjoyed yourself as you listen right now to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. Well, the world rolls on. Theater and productions roll on all over the city. We're going to talk about a couple of them during the course of the program today. We're going up the street. It's not even a block. Is it 400 feet?
Barely
400 feet up to the Warwick Theater,
mm-hmm.
where the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater at the Warwick is in the middle of their run of City of Angels. Larry Gelbart wrote the book for the show. Cy Coleman, did we say,
mm-hmm.
wrote the music for the show, and it's a musical, and it's all about, oh, I want to say 1940s noir, mm-hmm. just like our favorite kind of pictures, mine
yeah.
anyway.
It's a 1947 film noir musical that marries multiple worlds, the real world of 1947, where the writer is putting together his book, and then the Hollywood world, where the movie is coming together, and of course the characters of the book come to life. And sometimes they have opinions about things.
Of course. course.
And how that's going.
Now, Larry Gilbart, of course, let's fill you in. He was one of the creators of MASH. Mm-hmm. So you have that sense of... He was also part of the team of writers who wrote on your show of shows, along with Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, a host of other famous mm-hmm. writers. Can you imagine what those writers' meetings were like? but he wrote this. So he had a special love, I guess, for the 40s and film noir.
And I think for good comedy. Let me tell you guys who we've got here.
Okay.
I'm Karen Paisley with Metropolitan Ensemble Theater, and also to my left we have...
Christiana Coffey.
And to her
Tim
left...
Alanius.
Who are members of our cast for City of Angels. I guess we have... How many people with us on the show?
There are 18 actors on stage, and about 12 musicians?
In the orchestra?
In the orchestra, half a dozen stagehands... It takes a small little army to get this thing up and running on a night.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a big machine. Yeah, it's a really, really cool play. And, of course, our 18 actors are playing multiple characters. Everybody, I think, except for two, play more than one person.
Yeah.
And then one fellow, Jefferson, I think, plays four.
Right.
Yeah, Jefferson's got maybe has the lead.
And Curtis has three.
Yeah, Curtis has three. Jefferson has four. Bob has like two or three. Everybody has doubles except for Michael Dragan and John Cleary, who play the writer who created the book. And John Cleary plays the detective, who's the central character in the Sam Spade kind of novel thing.
Sure.
And they are each other's
muse
and nemesis simultaneously.
It is a film within a play.
Yeah.
A story within a story.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really complex the way it hangs together. And then you start, it comes together very beginning. You have introduction scene, and then scene two, you meet the writer. So you kind of start going, I get it now. And then the stage gets divided in different ways. So you have the film noir lighting in one section. So we try to keep our movie people looking a certain way and have our book characters looking a certain way. And so it's very different from anything we've ever done in this space.
Well, you really taxed your lighting person then.
She certainly was.
who did you have do
that?
That
was me.
Oh, you?
So it has really been a challenge. I've never done anything like that. And James hung it and was the board operator. And now Sean Walden is the board operator because James is running sound. But it's been a very interesting experience because we're doing it in the channel stage, which was the same style we used for Shawshank Redemption. And so when we did Shawshank, which Tim was in, mm-hmm. I was up at the booth going, this could be really interesting. I've never done a musical like this. Michael Dragan, of course, reminded me actually that Ragtime was in the channel stage, and we had done that together. He said, you do too know how to do this. So we put it together.
He doesn't sound like that. Though.
Not really.
No.
Unless the character.
No, well, unless the character. Well, I think it is a challenge in this space, especially with this play where it has multiple scenes in both acts. There's not really a set piece. There might be one set piece where we call it with this doors that open and close, but everything has to be mobile and has to disappear in a matter of seconds to create a whole new scene because it goes back and forth in time, back and forth in reality and functionality.
Since that you are headed that direction, a little bit about the plot of the story.
Well, the plot of the story, it starts off with the beginning of the book. Stein wrote a book. The character Stein, and we still don't know what his first name is. The character Stein wrote a book, and in that character, that book was conceivably bought by Hollywood to be turned into a movie. And in the process of converting that book into a screenplay, he goes, meets my character, Buddy Fiddler, and they're working together to try to craft this script for the movie. And you can imagine the give and take, or the take and the take, that goes on from the production side to the Hollywood side. But through that, Stein is still writing the movie, and other people are helping him do that, and the characters that are in his reality start appearing in the movie script and vice versa. It's kind of works in that matter. So it's the process of him developing this story, then getting it to a filming stage, and then him being challenged about what he is willing to sacrifice for his art and what he's willing to take back.
Now, there's a famous Hollywood reporter named Jimmy Fiddler. Do you think that's where Gilbart got the idea?
Yeah, quite possibly. Yeah. He uses names throughout the whole process. Preston Sturges' name pops up. Betty Grable's name pops up. He wasn't afraid to bring out those names from those periods of time.
Oh, sure. People he worked with. Now, tell us about your character, then I'll I'll ask Christiana the same thing.
I play the character of Buddy Fiddler, who is the producer and director of the film that is the book is going to be based off of. And he's your prototypical kind of 1947 director who just feels like they're in complete and total control of everything. And so it's almost like he's trying to puppet master Stein to get him to what he wants him to do and what he wants him to say and how he wants it to be. And Stein is somewhat of a willing participant within that. But Buddy has pretty significant ego. And he can't imagine that anybody would see it any other way than he sees it.
Oh, sure. What about Christiana?
So I play two characters. Avril Raines, which is the actress, so in the Hollywood side of it, which I interact with Buddy. And then in the movie, my character's name is Mallory, which she is the sort of catalyst for the detective plot. So the detective is sent on a,
The journey to find Mallory.
He's hired to find her.
Yes, yeah. He's hired to find her, and that is the catalyst that leads to all sorts of chaos after that. So, and that is the character that I actually have the song. My song is as the character, whereas I feel like a lot of the Hollywood... Well, I guess there's lots. Anyways.
No, that's okay. Go
on. Yeah. With the two different characters, it's... So Avril Raines is playing Mallory in the movie. She is hired as the young starlet to play this role.
Yeah.
So. It's fun to see, because how we wrote it, the characters that are playing in the movie interact with Stein's character, and they're petitioning for their own successes, or their own screen time, as it were. And in fact, there's one point, it's just like, I think Mallory says that, Buddy says, I get to stay till the end, and Stein's like, no, I think we killed you off. And I'm like, well, that's not what Buddy says. And having that kind of back and forth, it's fun to see, and Karen did a great job of bringing parts of reality, and all of a sudden, even from a set piece, that desk that was in reality is now a desk that's in the movie scene. And so you see, it's almost like Buddy's taking parts of his own, Stein is taking parts of his own existence, and it starts showing up inside of his book. As we all write with it, we write what we know.
Sure.
And so he's bringing all that stuff in and bringing these characters in, and that matter is a fun way to weave the two worlds together.
Sure, and it's all inside your mind.
Yeah.
It's a cerebral journey.
It's a scary place.
As it were. What kind of philosophy did you have going into this? Did you want to emphasize the noir? And maybe we should explain noir. When I say film noir, what do I mean, Karen?
Well, I'm sure there are other people who have far, far, far more knowledge about that from a film context. I always think of Barbara Stanwyck. I guess that when I go film noir, I think, oh yeah, Barbara Stanwyck, and all these cool clothes, and the light in the dark, and the cool hats and the big shoulders, and in the colorized world, it was Dick Tracy, when that came out, and then Sin City. This, I tried to start out pretty strict in the look of the film noir, so we could make a real strong opening choice. So you go, this is it. This is different from this. And then later on, as we worked through the story and the worlds began to bleed into each other a little bit, then allowing bleed-in moments to happen became one of the things we started to play with. And then there's a time when the two leading characters invade each other's worlds in a second. And that's a real exciting moment on stage when the writer and the character he's writing have this marvelous duet together. It's just a blow your socks off song. And then all of a sudden in the staging of it, created it so they crossed each other's worlds. And in the Broadway production, they're pretty strict because they're doing it on a proscenium stage, like here's the little box. And this side is this and this side is that. We're doing it in a big channel stage. Well, there's multiple ways to divide that. It doesn't have to be on one axis. So I do it, I think, three different ways in terms of this division, then the down the center division, this diagonal, maybe four actually. And then sometimes I give each world the whole stage. And so I think that flexibility was fun for me. So in the philosophy, I did feel like as we were lighting, I felt like we learned a lot as we went. We started out and doing it, and I was really nervous about it, but it came together. I'm not unhappy with the product. I think it looks cool, and the clothes are cool. The music is amazing. This is just one of the most amazing scores you've ever heard. The play itself won 6 Tony Awards in 1990. And I think that we really get trumped by, not to, you know, put the smack on Nicolas Cage and his City of Angels movie, but this is not that. This is a whole different thing. And I guess if you have to pick time to spend, I would pick this of those two. But this is gorgeous and lush, and the music is just to die for.
Now, tell us about the music. You each have individual numbers.
Yeah, so the orchestra is actually more of like a jazz combo, and the music is all very much very straight jazz. There's a jazz quartet that is basically acts as the ensemble. We don't actually have ensemble numbers except for a few bars at the very end where we all sing mm-hmm. together. So it's a different musical in that aspect, that the ensemble is not constantly singing throughout the production. Instead, we sort of have this underlying narration from the jazz quartet. So it's all really jazzy, and there's lots of jazz standards that have actually come from this show that now, you know, people do, you know, if you go to any of the jazz clubs, you'll hear songs from this show. And people don't realize it's from this show, but it's where it came from, so.
Now, you're a young lady. Were you familiar with some of those songs before?
Yeah,
you...
actually, the song that I sing, Lost and Found, I had no idea mm-hmm. came from this show. Didn't really know the context, but that is one of the songs that I hear when I do go listen to jazz music, is many people have covered that song, so.
Sure. Well, what about Tim?
They're kind of a...
and get closer to the mic for me.
The orchestra kind of gets a little... they're kind of the under... and when you watch a movie, there's always a soundtrack. When you watch a television show, there's always sound going on. And this orchestra plays that throughout most of the pieces. There's very few times when there's just dead silence, and it's just talking. Mm-hmm. In contrast to where you see a lot of musicals, particularly musicals from that quote-unquote time period, there's some heavy subject matter going through with it as well. There's some great thematic conversations happening both in the score and in the dialogue. But then there's the fun stuff too. I mean, my character Buddy Fiddler has it's called the Buddy Theme, and it's all about how he has all the power in Hollywood, and if you just do it the way I tell you to do it, it'll all work out fine. And it's fun, and it's campy, and it's jazzy, and it's and all that. But then there's songs like Funny, where the character of Stein is really going through the internal battle of what he's doing and why he's doing what he's doing. The characters Uli and who plays Uli and Donna, played by Corey Weber, she has some amazing songs that really just dive into who she is and what she's doing. And same with Lea Swank Miller, who plays Bobby and
Gabby, the
Gabby,
wife.
The wife, mm-hmm. and her challenge with her husband going through this process, too. So it's not just toe-tapping, let's go away for a Saturday evening or Sunday matinee and feel like everything's just going to be free and easy. It's going to challenge you to think about what's going on and, mm-hmm. and how things happen, too.
It's a super intelligent piece of music. And so when we think combo, sometimes we think three or four musicians. There's 12 really killer musicians up there. With Pam Watson on the keyboard, mm-hmm. he's just bringing it home every day. And it's really an amazing sound. I think that's one of the most exciting things about it to me, is hearing the music at that level, filling the Warwick up, and what it feels like. And then when you start with them, and then the jazz quartet begins, and this isn't necessarily, you know, when we think of super slow motion, you know, deep caramel stretchy music in a slow kind of way. This stuff drives. So this is more like in the spirit of, you know, some of the Dave Brubeck stuff, some of the more really lively jazz, as well as beautiful Gershwin and stuff that along that line. So when you listen to some of Corey's songs, there's Gershwin's. And I think that some of the ballads are in the same style, too. But there's a really beautiful context to these things. But the struggle the character is going through about his book, and it's not just his book. His wife says to him flat out, when are you going to learn to like yourself more so you can stand it when other people don't? And then be who you are. And so his journey to owning his own integrity, and where's the line? You know, where's the thing I won't cross, what I won't trade away? and him coming to the recognition that to be myself, to be who I am and be the man I can be, requires me at some point to say enough and be willing to do whatever is necessary to create a world I live in, where I am okay with it. And sometimes you say yes, and sometimes you say no.
Yeah. It's an inner struggle. It always is.
Mm-hmm. I remember in grad school, one of my coaches, my writing coaches, said, and he wrote for Hollywood and soap operas and all this stuff. He said, you say yes until you mean no. Because you can always come back and change it later. So when he was talking about negotiations, particularly with, you know, with Hollywood, or if you write a play and somebody wants to do it, you know, so go and listen. Just say yes until you mean no. And then when you run into your no, there it is. You know what it is. But up until that point, you don't have to turn it down. And I've thought of that several times as we were doing this, because that seems to be what's happening to him. You know, that he keeps saying yes because he's okay enough with it until the moments come that he's trading away things that are at its core. And one of those things are the values that he's expressed in his book, particularly about social justice and racial equality and fairness, in addressing some big ideas that need to be addressed, that Hollywood then says, we need to not talk about those things.
Well, that was the 40s, of course.
Right. And he's like, that's what made it art. And yet that's what they wanted him to take out.
Yeah, that's one of the things missing when you watch those old movies, mm-hmm. and they're on cable channels every weekend. They don't talk much about those particular issues.
Mm-hmm. But even still, it was
the mob and right. Hollywood and all that, but not that.
That's what sold the tickets in. But even still, with the book being written as it is for 1989, the subject matters that they're tapping in at that time are the ones that we're facing right now. It was way ahead of their time. Mm-hmm. I mean, we didn't really think about that in those terms back in then, but nowadays it's like, oh, that plays a much bigger stance right now based off of a lot of the movements that have gone around in our recent past.
Yeah, well, when he wrote MASH, Gelbart, when he wrote MASH, for instance, he was talking about Vietnam.
Oh, yeah.
But he made it Korea.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Correct.
So what about the costumes? Had it been hard finding enough things that worked for you?
Yeah, I don't think so. I thought it would. But I think we've done a lot of shows that are in that period. So we have a fair number of things. And I think most of it was acquired from our stock. And there's some things that had to be ordered. I mean, when you need a really amazing boa, you just have to have that. You have to go find those things.
Oh, those hats.
I mean, the hats, yeah. You know, and all the good stuff. But I think it was kind of amazing that when we were doing the fittings for the men for the tuxedos and all that stuff, I thought, there's no way in the world we're going to have enough tuxedos for all this. And then all the guys were there, and we started pulling them out. And lo and behold, there was enough. So it feels like, and when that kind of thing starts to happen, I guess for me, as the person trying to coordinate some things sometimes, it's sort of like it makes me have an extra piece of confidence that this was meant to be.
Well, sure.
It was already collecting itself here so we could do it. And I think the moment that Michael Scahill came on in his exceptional purple suit, that's when I knew, kind of like, yeah, we were really supposed to do this. Because this suit is perfect on him.
Performances pick up again on Wednesday the 26th mm-hmm. at 7:30, Thursday the 27th, 7:30. Also Friday on the 28th at 7:30. Performance on Saturday the 29th at 7:30, and concludes with a Sunday afternoon matinee on the 30th at the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater at the Warwick, located at 3927 Main, just up the street from us. I usually say a rock. I better not do that. I could throw a really soft softball up the street and get the front window of the Warwick Theater. The number to call for more information, 816-569-3226. Or, of course, you can go online at metkc.org. We're speaking with Karen Paisley, the artistic director of the Met and the director of the show. Tim Alanius plays the role of Buddy Fiddler. And Christiana Kaufman, who plays Mallory and Averill in the show as well. Kind of a film noir feel to things. Mm-hmm. It had to have been a lot of fun putting it together. You wanted to talk about your next season.
Oh, yeah.
So let's take a few minutes and do that.
Yeah, sure. It's been a while. Well, not a while putting it together. We've had it together for a couple of months now. But I'm really getting excited about it because I was kind of holding a yardstick up to every play that I was thinking about to decide, is there a reason to do this? You know, what's the cultural relevance of this? Because it's sometimes just do stuff because it's really great fun. And all these are really great fun. But it's also kind of cool to do something that you know that at the end of the day, the world might get better if we do something.
Well, hopefully.
And we can all have fun in the process you know, and learn something. And I'd always been really interested in Oscar Wilde, but I'd never read Gross Indecency, which is the three trials of Oscar Wilde.
Yes.
And then picked it up one day. There it was in my study. So I thought, oh, hey, well, look at that. And kind of fell in love with it. And I'm interested in doing that with, it's always been known with all men, which I think is just lovely for them. So we're going to mess that up and then come back and do a non-binary cast with that so that we can have men and women in this play and have Oscar Wilde be Oscar Wilde in all the roles we played by a multitude of people so we can play with that. And then was looking at doing Oliver with the idea that from a modern relevance standpoint, London was an inner city. Oliver is a lost child in the inner city. He runs into a bunch of criminals, some of whom are not so bad, and some of them are way, way, way bad. And then is looking to find love again, and what is love and kindness, and discovers that here's great evil, and here is great goodness. And the great goodness is what ultimately gets him home. And so looking at that story as it lies in that context. And then Proof by David Auburn, which won the Pulitzer Prize. That'll be in January. And then She Loves Me, which is a gorgeous Valentine of a musical. We got the rights to Mother of the Maid, written by Jane Anderson. It starred Glenn Close this past year on Broadway. And going to be doing that in March about Joan of Arc and her mom. And then a new play, The Nowhere Girl, which I wrote actually about, I guess, 15 years ago. Back in the day when I was studying with these people in New York and writing a lot of plays. And actually, Rebecca Ralston, one of the actresses in our play, and I were out to dinner with a group of people, and she sat down, turned her shoulder over to me, and she said, "So, I know you have plays. Why aren't we doing them?" She says, "You've got them hidden in your office. I know you do." And so then I went home that night and dug it out. I thought, well, there you are. And I thought it would be dated, but it turned out when we read it, it wasn't. So I gave it to a few other people to read and give me some feedback on it and see if something we wanted to do. And all of them said, yeah, let's do this. So we are.
Yeah, well, some theaters do different things. Certain theaters do only new stuff. Mm-hmm. Some theaters, you do usually traditional type
things. Or classic stuff, or major masterworks and contemporary classics and stuff. So I think this will be fun. I was surprised. It was interesting when you read something you've written, but you haven't read it in 15 years. I had forgotten what it was all about until I started reading it. And I was like, so it was really like reading a play that someone else had written.
Well, you were probably a different person 15 years ago. My goodness.
Marries a lot of ideas together. It has to do with being a kind of a modern woman, a working woman, and all this stuff in our industry. And because in our world, in the world, at least for women, particularly in the performing arts and film especially, deciding to have a family is a really big deal. That can end your career. You know, that it may be all over. And it's certainly life-changing for everybody. So that's kind of what a lot of this play is about. When Caroline decides, she's pregnant and she's a film actress. And she's very famous. And so it turns into a really, really big deal that this is happening with her.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that. I'm sure we'll be hearing from you as next season comes along.
Down.
City of Angels resumes tomorrow night, or Wednesday night, I should say, the 26th at 7:30. Performances in the evening, then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, and Sunday afternoon a matinee at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater at the Warwick, 3927 Main. If you need to MapQuest things, you need that zip code 64111, the number to call for more information and questions. I like it when people call and ask a lot of questions. You probably don't. But I like telling people that because they ask me questions and I say, call them. 816-569-3226 or online at metkc.org. I want to thank you all for coming
and
telling us about the City of Angels, a film noir comes alive on the stage of the Warwick Theater.
Yeah, make your plans.
Resuming again on Wednesday, Karen Paisley, the artistic director of the Met and the director of the show, Tim Alanius.
There you go.
Plays the role of Buddy Fiddler. I had a feeling that Gelbart was thinking of Buddy Fiddler.
Jimmy Fiddler, for sure.
On the show. And Christiana Kaufman, who plays the role of Mallory, and Averill,
yes.
I did write that down completely. In the Metropolitan Ensemble Theater production of City of Angels, resuming Wednesday. Just 400 feet away, maybe less. Up at the Warwick Theater.
Yeah, it's close. Easy to get to. Lots of parking.
Good for the big marquee on Main Street.
In back. I would try to park in back. Not too much parking probably on Main.
Well, Main and Act, but there's tons down Westport Road now with all the diagonal parking they put in and a great crosswalk. It's really kind of cool. At nighttime, it's amazing how bright it is out in front. And our building, we always light it up at night so you can see really well. There's a great place to drop people off, too, at the front, and then have your driver drop off at the back.
Sure. Well, thanks so much for coming by.
It's a pleasure.
We're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to talk about time traveling and all kinds of stuff like that. Fun stuff. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI. 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. It's nothing less than a cinematic miracle. The folks at Pixar have gone back to an old mine and found more gold. Toy Story 4 is a brilliantly conceived and executed animated story that works as a comedy, as an action adventure, and as an emotionally satisfying conclusion to the series. As usual, Pixar's animation is flawless, but they focus their efforts on creating a meaningful screenplay that tackles some complex issues. Toy Story 4 is the best movie of 2019 so far. Expect the box office to go to infinity and beyond. And speaking of toys, everyone's favorite homicidal doll has returned. Chucky is back in a reboot and a reimagining of the modern horror classic Child's Play. Aubrey Plaza plays a single mom who gives her son a buddy doll, and all heck breaks loose. This time out, instead of being possessed by the spirit of a serial killer, Chucky is the product of artificial intelligence gone awry. Mark Hamill, yes, that Mark Hamill, provides the voice of the evil doll. With its emphasis on mordant humor, this version may not play as well with some fanboys, but that wacky apocalyptic final act builds enough steam to please undemanding fans. Also opening this week, Anna is yet another action thriller about a female assassin. Pavarotti is a documentary about the famed Italian tenor Luciano Pavarotti. 5B is a documentary about the caregivers who risked all to help AIDS patients in the early 1980s. The Spy Behind Home Plate is a documentary about Mo Berg, the professional baseball catcher who was also a spy during World War II. This One's for the Ladies is a documentary about male strippers and the women who love them. And we're being offered two different horror anthologies, VHS 2 and Nightmare Cinema. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
KKFI presents Collaborations Live on June 29th at the historic Folly Theater Stage, downtown Kansas City, Missouri. Just to highlight a few performances, Traditional Music Society will bring African drums and dance to perform with Kelly Hunt to tell the story of how the banjo came out of Africa and has influenced us ever since. Shug Easy, the hip-hop dancer, will be performing with The Wires, a string duo, and Kaylee at the Crossroads, a Celtic dance group. The list goes on and on. Here's how it works. The artists will be performing on stage together. One artist will leave, be joined by another artist. They perform together for a little bit, and then one leaves and another takes their place, and so on for the rest of the evening. All of the event information and ticket pricing, which begins at just $10 all the way up to a VIP experience, is at kkfi.org/events or at follytheater.org.
Sounds exciting. It's coming up. Go to the station's website, kkfi.org, and find out all about it. Welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. We're going to talk about, oh, time travel, flying through the solar system, and all kinds of stuff. And it will all take place on the stage of the Theater for Young America at Union Station.
That's correct. City Stage.
Yeah, we're not supposed to call it the block anymore.
I've heard
the story on that, but I better not repeat it.
We just don't talk about it. We just go City Stage.
We just talk about the City Stage Theater, where the Theater for Young America will be presenting A Wrinkle in Time.
Just looking
at the publicity that you've sent out, and I've gotten quite a bit of publicity
good.
For this one.
Oh, I'm
good.
Glad.
Diane looks like a Ms. Harry Potter up here.
She does.
With the glasses and everything.
Diane has she plays Mrs. Who quotes all the time, all these wonderful, and she could handle all of these different languages with ease, and she makes it come just trippingly off of her tongue. You know, I love those characters, the three. Mrs. Who, Mrs. Which, and Mrs. What's It.
That was the voice, by the way, of Valerie Mackey. She is the artistic director for Theater for Young America, and she is the director of this particular show. You direct almost everyone.
I do. Sometimes Stephen will come in and direct, and sometimes Jean will direct one show a year or something like that.
Yeah.
But I now have wonderful choreographers because... I've gotten old, Michael.
Oh, no. Valerie does it all. Does everything. She's also a choir director. She's a knockout singer.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I lead the music up at Unity of Kansas City North.
And I'll get to the subject. But
Somebody else is the choir director.
Do you still travel once in a while with the menopause show?
With menopause. No, I have gotten out of menopause. No, I'm just kidding. About the
we have a...
there was a double entendre there, you know. I have taken a break from that to focus on the theater. I'm still very close with all of the people from there. And, of course, my good friend Terry still tours. And I keep up with everybody. We have a tight family. Once you've been on a really big tour that goes all over, a bus and truck tour, you stay close, you know. With the producers as well. I'm good friends with all of them.
Oh, that's great.
And revel in all of their good fortune with different, awards and things like that.
Now, from what I read about it, this is a well-known play. Now, usually Gene Mackey writes a lot of your scripts, but he didn't write this one.
Well, he didn't write the book, of course. Madeline Lingle wrote this amazing book back in 1962. And so it has kind of a simplistic view of space and space travel and this thing called the Tesseract, which they go into. I call them the witches, but it's the three kind of...
Guides,
we'll call them. Yes, very good. That's thank you, Elroy.
Yeah, Elroy Hawkins is also here. He plays the role of...
Mrs. Witch.
Very good.
That's her title.
We don't assume any genders.
That's right. And Josephine Lenardi?
Yes,
is here, and
me.
You play the role of...
I play Meg.
Meg, okay.
Kind of the lead character in this adventure.
Wow.
She's the one who is... We first meet her in the beginning as she is going through a time where she's dealing with her father being missing for a certain amount of time. And so she's having trouble at school. She's beating up other boys and stuff. So she is trying to deal with these emotions. But then in come these guides who kind of say, there is such a thing as a Tesseract. And then she goes on this adventure. Who else do you go on the adventure with?
I go on the adventure with my little brother, whose name is Charles Wallace, in the play. And we end up going on this crazy adventure. And we meet a friend from my school named Calvin. And so it's me and those two boys who are on this crazy adventure to find my father.
Yeah, he's... Not to give anything away, but it said it in the publicity. So he's in a galaxy far, far away.
He is. They go to several planets. The first one is Uriel.
Is the first planet. Yes.
Yes. But then her father, they discover, is on Kamazots. where the kind of the evil it has taken over the control of the brains of all that. I mean, I'm telling you, this is like straight out of Buck Rogers and Star Trek, but you know, as we approached it from a really honest place, you know, we set the whole stage in a in really a starscape. So they're on these platforms with stars behind them all the time. So we kind of, my view of it was that we are placed in space. We just happen to be on Earth with all of these walls and things around us. But I place this whole adventure in space. So wherever they are, they're in a different part, but in the greater view of this space.
Sure. Well, they're still the same people, no matter where they are.
I know.
And you have to make the situation real. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But I remember Margot Kidder telling me that when I interviewed her years ago. I asked her about Lois Lane and the fantasy aspects of it. She said, I just thought of her as a real girl reporter who was trying to make it in the big city, and I didn't depart from that mindset.
Right.
And that's the way you have to play it.
Right. We really tried to play each emotion and each kind of interaction in a realistic way.
There's a lot of aspects to Meg that I can personally relate to. I mean, because in the story, she's around my age. I'm 16. She's kind of given that same age range. She's just a teenager who's struggling with a lot of real things that I've seen that have happened to me or even friends. And so, honestly, it's not that hard to put me in her shoes when on stage, but just getting in the mindset of telling her story and just being real in those emotions, because the story behind her and the things that she learns on this journey are so important to any age range, to any, they can speak to anyone on different levels, no matter what you're dealing with, and it all boils down to love, and dealing with hardships in a sense and taking on responsibilities even if you don't think you're prepared to.
Well, you have the same lessons to learn no matter how fantastic the story might be.
Yeah.
You as an individual have the same lessons to learn. What about Elroy? Explain Mrs. Witch to
Mrs.
me.
Mrs. Witch is one of three characters who, like we said earlier, are the guides for these children on their adventure to discover their relationships with each other and themselves, and to find their father. And so there's multi-purpose for them. Mrs. Witch seems to be the oldest of the three of the three guides.
And the handsomest. And,
shucks, man.
I'll bet so, yeah.
And the flashiest.
He's covered in glitter from head to toe.
I'm covered in glitter, and I can't tell you how much fun it is washing glitter off of places that you didn't realize you could get glitter. But it's all in the aspect of telling the story. This character is a little more ethereal than the others, I guess because she has lived longer. We're going billions of years by their time.
Wow.
So there's a lot of mystical shaman.
Oh well, I gathered that. I gathered that from the first time I read some of the publicity.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that going on. And you contribute to that
a little bit. I give what I can, but I am my character is the oldest, and I think is more of a caretaker for the kids, a protector, who I think my character really wants to make sure they are protected while they're in my stage of the journey.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you help guide them
them. All three of them
took a part journey.
During my part, I want them to understand that, you know, there's a lot of danger, but we're going to get through it, and I want to make sure you know what you're getting yourselves into and mm-hmm. that you are on board for it.
Yeah.
He definitely has the wisest character. You know, there's Mrs. Watson, who's very loving. Mrs. Who gives specifics. And also, all three of you are very loving.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that's interesting to me in the original 1962 book. At one point, Gray Christ, who plays Mrs. Watson, and then becomes this kind of flying beast, ethereal beast that flies them up into the air and things like that. I mean, it's all, but In the book, that these characters are described as he, she, its. This is in 1962.
Okay.
Therefore, I felt like, not assuming any gender, that at this point it could, we don't even address the notion that he's a Mrs. Witch. That's the name he's given himself to appear to these children on Earth. But yet, he is really part of something bigger, like a star, really. So it's that he, she, it, and that is in the book. Mm-hmm. Isn't that fascinating?
It was interesting. It was kind of early thinking, I guess.
I believe so. I believe so. Madeline Lingle, I think she was looking at like a bigger picture, So.
Well, we don't know what's in the universe. What could be involved there. We have no concept.
Exactly.
And this becomes an epic battle, really, of fighting good over evil. Which is a great it's a great hunk of meat to bite off, And so we all have really enjoyed, and this cast is amazing.
Oh, tell us.
Oh, sure. Well, Diane Boulan is playing Mrs. Who, and she is just delightful to work with in any capacity. And Greg Christ is Mrs. Watsit. Marcus Merritt, a young man heading to college, plays Calvin, who is kind of becomes best friends with Meg, a la love interest type, but definitely a confidant and that type of, wouldn't you call that?
Yeah, definitely.
And then Charles Wallace is played by Kieran Ford, a young actor, excellent, great to work with. He's done a couple of shows for us, and just has instincts like killer instincts, just very honest, but also just can be go weird too. Because like last year we did Dracula, and he became like this shadow creature around Dracula. He was like so creepy and weird, and I thought, well, he's got some range. And then we have Isaac Robinson, who's done a lot of shows for us as well, young actor who plays the man with the red eyes, and he is creepy, and he does a lot of Shakespeare as well. And then we have Mika Westra and Zanda Pilley, who are both our stage managers, but they each do a role in the show, and then they tag team in the booth. They have it all worked out, where it's amazing. They know exactly when they press this, she comes in, and then she goes down. So Zanda Pilley plays Meg's mother, Mrs. Murray. I really wanted that dynamic in it. So when I kind of, Gene did adapt some of this, and then I adapted the rest of it to tell the story, because I have a little different perspective than Gene.
Uh-huh.
And so I pulled in, even though we are very aligned in what we see and how we want to tell a story, but I wanted to pull in the mother in this. And I thought that was really important, and it really gave a really honest dynamic. And then Mika plays the happy medium, who's this crazy little character on some planet, and who then can tell them, kind of like our mediums, where they have she has a crystal ball and everything. But what's interesting about that is her mother keeps saying to her that she's so extreme. She keeps telling you. What does she tell you?
Mother always said I should find a happy medium.
So it's.
Did she mean that exactly?
Who knows?
Did I miss anybody?
Perry Llewellyn.
Oh my gosh! Well, this is an interesting. Yeah, I had him first, and then I realized. Oh wait, I want to talk more about that. Perry Llewellyn plays her father. But he is behind. Charlie Whitecamp did our set. Charlie Whitecamp and Kyler Green did our lights and our set. Amazing. I mean, truly amazing. He made these screens that we can see through. So Perry Llewellyn stays behind as father, Mr. Murray. He stays behind the screen almost all of the time. So he's always present. And that was something that Xanda Pilley and I, as we were going through production meetings, she said that and said, wouldn't it be great if he was just always there? And then we all went with that, and we love that idea, and his just presence is there so that he's not that far away, and yet he's unreachable.
Mm-hmm.
So
he's galaxies away, yet he's there within your reach at the same time.
And she does get him.
Or at least the memory and essence of him are there.
Right. But then she finds him. And what's interesting is she saves him. When, you know, and he was, it's an interesting, she saves him. And then she wants him to fix everything. But then she realizes it's all within her.
Uh-huh.
And so she gets to, you know, fix it all. And you help to build that up and, you know, and teach that. This is a good group of actors.
Sounds like it's probably a more difficult directing job than normally would be.
Well, you know, each directing job is I just approach it as exactly for what it is. This got a little bit, I would say we went a little deeper, but the still, you know, the blocking is definitely my style of blocking. You know, I do areas and I establish strong wares and create beautiful pictures while telling the story. So everything that we do tells a story. Mm-hmm. And there's some kind of it weaves together. Like when Aunt Beast, oh, that's the other character
Elroy plays.
Aunt Beast.
On one of the planets that we go to, which is actually, we land there by accident because the father's been rescued. Won't give too much away, but it landed there by accident, and Meg wakes up in the arms of this creature on this particular planet, and we're trying to figure out what she's going to call this creature, because we've never had to be called anything before, and we come up with the name Aunt Beast.
Oh, okay.
And we become two of us. Diane and I actually played the beast together. So the two of us come together and create one creature, and we become this nurturing, nursemaid character that kind of nurses Meg back to health to get her ready to go continue her journey and finish her adventure. So we're nursing her back to health at this moment and create just one little scene, create this mother and daughter, father and daughter kind of in relationship. And someone saw the show early on and said, oh my God, that scene, you look like crap, but I loved the scene, which I didn't think about before.
Well, not like crap. You know, crazy.
It's crazy. It's a creature, a two-headed creature with different, you know, arms and
four different arms and fur hanging off.
Your costuming.
And
your costuming person would have a problem.
Oh yeah. my goodness. Yeah, it required its own training and rehearsal just to be able to get into that thing.
Zach did a beautiful job.
And they do this really cool thing with their voices where Elroy kind of echoes exactly what Diane says right after her, and they do this, like, mixing thing, and Aunt Beast is one of my favorite scenes in every play just because it's the dynamics between them is so loving and nurturing, and it's such a shifting point for Meg in the story. Because I feel like that scene is really where she starts to feel her own power.
Now, what I have here, performances start tomorrow, June 25th?
We actually started last week.
Okay.
Last Wednesday. But we run through
the 6th.
July 6th is what I have here. Mm-hmm. At the City Stage Theater at Union Station, 30 West Pershing Road. Yes, Union Station does have an address. And the zip code is 64108. Only tourists ask that. And I always chuckle.
Yeah, that's hilarious. You can see it from every highway.
GYA.org. That's the location on the web to go to for all the information. And you can make arrangements there, too. And the number to call is, I think I have the right one, 816 416-460-2083.
That is correct. Matt will be happy to take your call.
Sure. Now, the times are different than a lot of these productions. You have an early morning show.
We do. We have a 10 a.m. Now, we do have, we usually do 10 a.m. on Tuesdays through Fridays, and then we have 12 noon on Thursdays and Fridays. 2 o'clock on Saturdays, and then we do have another Friday at 7 p.m. show. I believe it's that weekend of the 4th of July, right around there. I'm sorry, I didn't grab my calendar.
No, it's all right. They can get that on your website. It'll probably be laid out
Facebook,
all there.
Friend us on Facebook.
Friend them on Facebook. You can get all the information that way as well. TYA, which stands for Theater for Young America, TYA.org, and you can get the dates and you can get the specific times when you can go. Boy, are the mornings, people are thinking, I want to take some kids. The mornings are the best?
Well, it depends on your child and your children. You know, this one is getting a broad range of kids coming to. What I loved is I was sitting next to the other day a little one. She was maybe three, maybe four. And there's some scary stuff in this. And she reacted appropriately. She went, "Ooh, this is scary. What's going to happen next?" She was right with it. But yet, there's enough really great language and story to bite onto that the older kids are liking it, too. So we're having big families come with all different ages. And summer camps and stuff are coming over as well.
You have your own summer camp, don't
we
you?
Do.
Or have you had it?
Well, this week we're doing Pete the Cat for the little younger ones, and then right after I think it's that next Monday, the 9th, we start The Hobbit, and that will be with some adults and then everyone in the camp. And it's fun to do.
Oh, they have camps. They have classes. some well-known people. The Geico monkey ape gorilla.
Oh, yeah. I was just talking to John.
Yeah. He was a student of hers.
Yeah. John is out in, he's doing a comedy show. Kind of about his journey of recovery and stuff through in Boston coming up. So if you're in the Boston area, go and see his show. It's going to be awesome.
Oh, sure. She has molded some fine actors.
Some great ones around town.
That's true.
And we do have, I was going to mention, we are doing another show at Avila, too.
So. Okay, at Avila as well. And then, of course, they'll have a new season coming up. I wish we had more time. But you can go to that website, TYA.org. It's really simple to remember. Or you can call the box office, 816-460-2083, and ask them all kinds of questions. Say that I did it. Blame me. You're thinking of all kinds of time. Thanks so much for coming.
Thank you, Michael.
So it's nice to hear.
Thanks for having us.
A true sci-fi story.
Yeah.
As well.
Yes.
Theater for Young America. The show is called A Wrinkle in Time, and they travel through space, through time, and it's very cerebral. It that makes it sound scary, and I'm sure it is in places, but it sounds cerebral, funny, and today's kids, if they watch any sci-fi at all. They're used to that.
Well, it's definitely
have a lot
simplistic
of
sci-fi, you know.
Thanks so much for being with us. Valerie Mackey, the artistic director of Theater for Young America. She's a singer and an actress herself, all of that. And Elroy Hawkins, who plays the role of Mrs. Witch. Yes, Mrs.
Yes.
Witch. If you listen to the podcast for the explanation, Mrs. Witch and Josephine Lenati,
yes,
plays the role of Meg in the Theater for Young America production of A Wrinkle in Time. Performances resuming this Wednesday, the 25th, and it will run through July 6th. And go to the website for the exact dates and the exact times on those days. Because it sounds like you have something for everybody: an evening performance, and mornings and
options,
and noons as well, probably.
Yes,
as well. Yeah.
Absolutely.
The City Stage Theater is the one on the lower level of of Union Station.
And we were just renovated, you know.
Yeah.
Last year.
In the daytime, it's you. In the nighttime, well, it could be anything.
Well, dance companies, but KCAT is right there, Kansas City Actors Theater.
Yeah.
We get to walk by and wave at them every day, too. So.
Sure. Thank you, Val.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. The Jazz Insider is next. He has some fine jazz planned. I peeked. He has some fine jazz coming up. We'll have jazz from 1 to 3. We'll have the blues from 3 to 6 right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen at that crossing the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.